Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where
prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus. Lucky Land Casino. Asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
What is it you want, Barry? What do you want? You want the moon? Just say the word and I'll throw a lasso around it and pull it down.
You want answers!
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
I see dead people.
All I know is that first, you've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm a human being. God damn it! My life has value!
Filmmaking Conversations with Damian Swaby is part of the critical conversations currently taking place across the film community. The podcast reaches out to the next generation of filmmakers who continue to look for inspiration and guidance. Remember to hit the subscribe button and leave a comment in the comments section. Share the podcast with friends and family, and have a great day. And now, over to the host of the show, Damian Swaby.
Bernard.
Hi.
How are you today?
I'm good. How are you, Damian?
I'm doing great. Started the day well, and now I'm speaking to you. So I'm very, very happy to hear about all you've got to say and what you've created with Centerframe. But before we get into that, please do tell us about yourself, for your history. Are you a filmmaker? Are you a tech guy? Are you an editor? What exactly do you do, Bernard?
What do I not do? My background is a little varied. Like, it took me a little bit to get to where I'm at now. But I started in the late 90s with graphics design and web design. So I was part of the sort of the early web boom. I was 18 years old. I was like, oh, web design, I'm going to get into this. And I went to the Art Institute of Dallas in Texas. So after I grew up in Austria. I went to Texas to do digital design, which focused primarily on CD-ROM interfaces and DVD menus and websites, you know, so that was the thing. And then while I was there, I took my first video production class, and I was immediately hooked. I was like, ooh, this is what I want to do, video production, you know, film production, the storytelling, that's my thing. So I went to University of North Texas in Denton, Texas, just north of Dallas, and I did the radio, television, and film program, where I learned about broadcast TV, film, and radio production. I was a radio DJ for a while. But this whole time, I was a techno DJ. I had my own record label, and in 2000. In 2000, I met a guy called Eric Esternell, who is now famous as Maceoplex, which I don't know if you know who that is, but he is a big worldwide well-known DJ. So if you see a big festival like Tomorrowland or Junction 2 or Coachella, like whatever you think of, he plays at those places and he's headlining his stages. So he's that kind of big. And I met him in the early days before he was that guy, you know? And so with his help, I started my own label and started releasing techno records, started pressing techno records. I still have a few of my leftover stock down here in my stash. But I learned about running a business from that, you know? And I was getting really good at it and stuff like that, but I was in film school. Like I was doing this and I was doing that, you know? So these things were sort of going simultaneously. But this was still school. So I was on a schedule doing that while I was running the label thing and while I was starting to tour and DJ and play in clubs, that kind of thing. And then in 05, I moved to London after I graduated in order to go to the London Film School to really focus on film production. Like, I wanted to be a filmmaker, be a director. The London Film School was the place where I thought, okay, this is the place that's going to give me that. And simultaneously, the whole DJing thing was still happening. And I suddenly had a golden opportunity to be headquartered in London, you know, and to really build the DJing thing and go down that way or do film. And neither of those, neither the music and my, because I was a music producer too, so neither music and DJing could be done part-time, and film also can't be done part-time. So I had to decide, and I thought, I mean, I love music, I love techno, I love all that, you know, but it's movies, it's storytelling. Like, that really spoke to my core. And so I thought, you know what? Sorry, DJing, sorry, music world. I'm going to put you guys on the back burner, and I'm going to go down the filmmaking route. And then I graduated. Went freelance, started my production company, Ironbox Films, which my label was Ironbox Music. So I just said, yep, I'm just going to take that and put it on this one. So Ironbox Films became that in 2007, but it was just me on my own. And yeah, and then just started doing bits work here and there, you know, just trying to build up my portfolio, trying to get some more work in, then started doing a couple of music videos here and there. And then in 2010, I partnered up with somebody I met on a film shoot while I was at film school, Nathan Haynes. And we still work together now, you know. I also partnered up with Raymond Behrens, who I went to film school with. And so we worked together. We ended up producing two movies together over the last 10 years. In the pandemic, Raymond and Nathan and I, we decided to part ways. Nathan and I still work together, but Raymond sort of went his own direction to pursue a new project he's working on. Nathan and I are here. And then another old film school friend that I went to school with joined us, Luis Villar. And that was basically just over a year and a half ago now. So he joined us, and his background, so he went from filmmaking straight into digital marketing years ago. So he's now part of our sort of core team at Ironbox, but also together, so we came up with this idea for Centerframe. All of our backstory is storytelling. Like, so I guess Nathan didn't go to my film school, but he did go to film school. And Luis went to film school with me. He was in my term. But when we graduated, we just took different paths and didn't reunite until recently. Luis ran a big digital marketing agency in Brazil. Like, that's where he's from originally. Oh. And his clients were, you know, Red Bull, and he ran political campaigns and all this stuff. So this was big. Like, this is proper big company, data-driven digital marketing agencies. And then he relocated to here after he was sort of finished with that, and he came over here and had a few clients. But then he was looking for something new and teamed up with us. And through that team up, we came up with the idea for Centerframe.
Amazing. You've done a lot.
So yeah, as I said, it's just a lot. You know,
yeah, I like it. You're well-traveled as well. So I really like that. You have chosen film over music. Why do you think that is? What's the difference between film and music for you that made you make the decision you made?
Oh my God. I mean, music, I love making music, and what was really appealing was the immediate feedback that music can give you. You know what I mean? Like, making it, you're sitting there, you hear it happen, you know, like the thing you're working at, the thing people are gonna hear, you're doing it right now. It's like crafting clay. You know what I mean? So the thing people are gonna see, you're molding it as we speak, you know. I love that. And it's fantastic. It's instant feedback, you know, that you can get from what you're working on. And then, of course, if you're a DJ that evening, you know, they're going to play that track to a crowd and you'll see how they react. And then, you know, and also the crowd, like you play it, instant feedback, and you can, and if they don't, and if they don't react the way you want, you can put on a different record, or you can play things differently, or you can change the track and, you know, mold what you're working on, you know? And that is hugely exciting. It's very invigorating, you know, but, I always felt like, what I wanted to do was tell stories, like really like beginning, middle, end stories. And while song can do that, of course, and while song and music and, you know, all this stuff can do that very, very well, that's not where my strengths were when it came to music. Yeah, I mean, I'm not a trained musician. I basically taught myself on a computer with Propeller Head Reason and Cubase, and like it was.
So did you use Reason Record?
No. I started with Reason One.
Oh,
yeah. I mean, that's how far back I go. Yeah, I mean, wow. I started with Reason One in 1998 or 99, whatever it was. In fact, I had Rebirth before then, which was the 303 simulator thing that they had. But then they built Reason, and I started with that. And I combined that with Cubase through Rewire, and that's how I made my music. Before that, I had Cakewalk and that, a few other things. But the real me, the good stuff was Reason and Cubase. That was my starting point. But again, it was the instant feedback. I loved that. But I'm not a trained musician. I knew there was a limit to my skills, you know, and my skills. And I knew I need to do so much more to get into. To get to a skill set level that I can get into storytelling with songs, you know, with tracks, you know. And techno is also not a storytelling genre. Yeah, you know what I mean, like techno, the storytelling happens as a DJ. You know what I mean, where you can play different things, but the track itself, in the end, is a tool for DJs to play and entertain an audience. You know what I mean, and the moment you make tracks that are a bit more thoughtful, a bit more thought-provoking, they stop being dance music, they start being listening music. You know, you start turning into more sort of Aphex Twin territory rather than, I don't know, Deadmau5 territory. Do you know what I mean? Like, once you start making the audience think too much, they stop dancing. And most techno tracks are made to make people dance. Like, the audience doesn't want to think while they're dancing. They want to enjoy it. They want to, you know, get with it, you know. And I was hovering that line really hard, and I enjoyed the challenge and I enjoyed making it work, but I was in film school. I was, that was my trajectory. I was gonna go and make movies, and I was going to three different schools effectively to learn how to do storytelling. And then this DJing thing was going to stop me from doing that, you know. And I was like, dude, look, I'm studying this for a reason. This is where I want to go, you know. And I had to make a decision, you know. I mean, and yeah, sure, technically, I could have maybe tried to do the whole DJing thing as well. But I was also becoming a father, and DJing and music making and fatherhood are not friendly. Not impossible. There are plenty of DJs I know that have kids that manage that world very well, but I couldn't also do filmmaking too, you know? Yeah. And so something needed to give, and fatherhood definitely wasn't going to give. I'm a very, very happy and proud dad.
Good for you.
But something needed to take a back seat, and music just sort of had to be it if I was going to have something that was much more to my core than the music, and something that I know I could get better at and still work on, you know, as it was going. And I love movies, man. I really do. Like from the get-go, like from as very little, all I was doing was watch TV. Like, my parents threw books at me and I just threw them back and said, give me the VHS. You know what I mean? Like, that was really, like, it was just not something that was me. Like, it was always, and as a kid, I was a very, very good liar. Yeah, I would totally convince you of almost anything, you know. And I knew that telling stories convincingly was extremely rewarding. I was like, oh my god, I just got away with this. You know what I mean? This is great, you know. And that was in my core. That was, it was right here, you know? And then I knew that about me, that I loved telling stories and getting away with it, you know? So I now wanted to find a way to harness that, you know, and making movies, telling stories to people is the thing that does that for me. So now I can just take all that little, that reward center that I had back then, like all the things that, like, you know, that instant reward from DJing, that was that too.
Yeah.
It's like, oh my God, this is immediately working for me. I can tell a story, people believe it, boom. And now I've turned that into my passion for storytelling, you know, and it's a fantastic release for me to just get, you know what, I can do, say whatever I want in the story world and people go, yeah, okay, tell me, you know, it's like, and there are no consequences for telling something fictional in this world, because that's what people want. They want to hear a story that can transport them somewhere. Yeah. I mean, whether it's something real or not. And I always loved that. And I loved telling those stories that got that let me do that, you know, and it was just always in me, you know, and music, as much as I loved it and as much as that was sort of part of it, it never sat that deep. Yeah. And, you know, does that make sense? And so the decision was fairly clear.
It's very clear, but there's something about the way you speak about music, and especially when you spoke about Rebirth and using Cubase and the instant gratification and your understanding of techno, which sounded completely correct, in my opinion. Mm. I can see you one day maybe picking up the latest software and giving it a go again. You know?
Oh, no, I still have it all installed.
Oh,
and
okay.
Every now and then. And I still have it all installed. Like, I have my records here. My turntables are back.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I've got my records hanging up. And so these are my releases, you know.
Yeah.
It's here. Like, I started with techno in 96 when I was 16 years old. That's when I started DJing. And I did it up until 2008 actively. That's 12 years of my life that are firmly embedded in my soul. Like, that's not going to go away. And as many, my friends, plenty of them have asked me, oh, dude, you're not DJing anymore. Just sell me your records. I was like, I can't do that. I can't possibly sell you my records. This is history. This is my, this is my time. You know what I mean? So it's, I can't, and like Maceoplex, he ran into some issues with some of the records he had where a bunch got stolen and this and that. And he's like, dude, you still have those records, right? Can I buy them off you? I was like, no, I can't, dude, you're asking the wrong guy. He's like, dude, you're not doing anything with it. I was like, dude, I can't, man, I just can't do it. This is deeply sentimental. Yes, it's true. Music is very much part of it. And I'm very much loving music, but like storytelling is it. Like, that's, I love it.
And storytelling is something you want to also do to help filmmakers, hence why you have Centerframe.
And absolutely.
The first thing I say before we get into it deeply of Centerframe is, I must admit, I was incredibly impressed by the video for Centerframe, the promo ad you do for it. Really, shot well, really lit well. Straight away, it convinced me to want to speak to you. Once you sent me the link of it, I thought, okay, this guy's got something on offer, and he's put the time and effort in to make it look valuable for us and for us to pay attention to. So tell us about Centerframe and why exactly did you come up with it?
Have you thought of upgrading your cinematography game? Would you like to have an ASC cinematographer mentor you for free? Join veteran cinematographer Suki Medenzovic, ASC, Disney, Pixar, FX Networks, Netflix, American Horror Story, as he teaches you how to create beautiful images using three lighting techniques he has mastered on film sets over his 30-plus years in the film industry. Each technique uses basic, low-cost lighting equipment so that anyone can achieve beautiful visuals no matter your project's budget. If you want to take your cinematography to the next level, visit filmmakingconversations.com to sign up for instant access.
Well, over the last 12 years of trying to make movies, you know, and successfully getting two films financed off the ground, and I was producing another one for a dear friend of mine, Stavros. That's his first film. Stavros Pambalis has a film called Siege on Liberty Street, which I helped him develop in the early stages of it. And then he ended up shooting in Cyprus back in 2018, I think it was, and is now sort of coming out, is finally getting its proper release. And so, yeah, being part of all that and still we're also developing, I really noticed that that the hurdle from getting to being an active storyteller, an active filmmaker, and even just making your first feature film, even if it's micro budget, that is such a massive step. Yeah. And really, really good storytellers. Yeah, a lot of it is sheer dumb luck. Yeah, I mean, that you can actually get the movie made, you know. And we made my first movie at £80,000. And that was basically my production company's capital that we just, you know, shoved into it, you know. And we had some extra investments, and we begged and borrowed from like parents and whoever else, you know. But we did that for £80,000, and that's it. You know, and then just a whole lot of our own time. I mean, if you watch the behind the scenes of Betsy and Leonard, it's Raymond, Nathan, and me vacuuming up we couldn't afford a stage, so we hired an unused furniture store that was basically empty, and we built our set inside there. And good then, of course, we didn't have money for a cleaning crew, so it was basically just us with vacuum cleaners and brooms and everything, just cleaning the whole thing out because we didn't have any money, you know. Yeah. So that's micro budget filmmaking, but it was such a joy. Like, it's one of my fondest memories is making that movie. I love it, you know. But then, you know, we made the movie and we tried to sell the movie, and the movie isn't bad. It's not a Godfather or anything, but it's a solid little romantic comedy. But this is 2012, 2013. Selling it was practically impossible. You know, like somebody buying it to, like, most distributors said, absolutely, we can't sell this. Like, nobody watches romantic comedies without stars. And the couple of people who did get it on board, they abandoned the project within, just selling it, you know, within a few months, saying, oh, this is not selling. And this is a solid little movie, you know. And that's the nature of making your first film, you know. And and then I've successfully managed to get a much bigger horror movie off the ground called Ravers. It took 5-6 years to get that up. We shot that in 2018. It premiered at Fright Fest. You know, it was a good sized production and everything. We had Georgia Hurst and Natasha Henstridge in it, you know. So this is like a good sized production for a horror movie. And even with that one, just trying to sell the movie to any entities, you know, and we're stuck with the financial risk of it. Like, it's all ours, you know, and we just realized that this is a really almost impossible world to be in as an indie filmmaker when you're trying to get movies off the ground. All the financial risk sits on you. Distributors take no risk whatsoever. In fact, they want to recoup their expenses before you before you earn any of yours. So therefore, they have no incentive to earn anything for you first. They just have an incentive to earn their money back first, which means low budget distributors get nothing. Yeah, you know, there's stories upon stories on the internet of filmmakers making movies, getting a distribution deal, and earning no money from it. But the distributors hold all the rights exclusively for a territory, you know. And that whole environment is like, how are you ever supposed to tell a good story, get it out there, and have the financial risk, and, you know, get through this and not piss off investors or people that you're responsible for? Yeah, you know, it's a complete minefield at this level of the industry, you know. And you're just trying to get your first movie made so you can prove to people that you're a good filmmaker. You know, and I've done two. I managed to make two movies, you know, which is already rare, you know, that people you get to make two, and one's a bigger one than the other one. You know, it still is an absolute minefield. And so what we realized is that the way it works now is that the way distributors work, what investors want, and what filmmakers can do are not in sync. You know what I mean? What the distributors only want to, at this level, distributors only want to get their own expenses back, you know, and do very, very well not earning you any money. And the filmmakers are not in a position to challenge them on anything because it would cost a whole lot of legal fees to try and extract any money from them. Also, there's no transparency on what you've earned. So that's not in sync. Investors, of course, are looking, saying, oh, well, it's a distribution deal, that those kinds of numbers. But then, because there's no real earnings, investors don't want to take any risks on lower films because the distributors can't promise any revenue, you know. So therefore, that is not in sync. And then, of course, the stories that filmmakers want to tell have to hit certain notches in order to be really easy sells, no matter how good the story is, you know? So it's far more important to be genre or to have a big star attached or something like that, which of course, how are you supposed to get those things if you've never made a movie before or anything like that? So therefore you're usually starting off with a bunch of unknowns because that's all you can really afford, but that's not enough to sell the movie. And then, you know, nothing here is in sync. You know what I mean? Like the investors aren't in sync, the stories people want to tell aren't in sync with the distributors and what they can sell or think is viable, and then they don't earn any money. So when we saw that, we're like, this can't be the way to do it. It's not possible that an industry has to work this way for all the indie filmmakers out there, let alone that there is no money in short films. So whatever short films you make, it's literally your cash and you're not going to ever see anything of it. But okay, you know what? That's always been that way. So I'm not going to say we can make money with short films. No, that's not what we're saying, you know? But documentaries have the same problem. You know what I mean? Documentaries, trying to get financing for documentaries from any funding bodies is really difficult. You basically have to be on the in with a broadcaster that finances you. You know, and that's a small group of documentarians. You know, most documentary short films get, again, funded out of budget, out of your own pocket, you know, and maybe you'll get somewhere with it, you know. So it's a really, really difficult world to be in. And art house cinema, for example, has to be entirely funded by art councils and local funding bodies and, you know, initiatives by museums or, you know, things like that, you know, that.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
That would help give you some money. But most of that money is also peanuts, you know, unless you're a big artist that has a big following already, you know. So it's a very, very difficult world to finance. But there's still lots of filmmakers and storytellers that want and probably have good stories that they just can't get out there. And film festivals are a mixed bag. Like, it's very difficult to get into film festivals because it's, you know, you have to get lucky that's the person that the film festival has to be legit. There's plenty of festivals that aren't, you know, so you always have to look for the ones that are legit, but then those are highly competitive because, well, guess what, everybody wants to get into those, and it's potluck to basically get into those because they have obviously their programming initiatives too, that they go, look, we'll do this, we'll do that, and if you don't fit in that, doesn't matter how good your story is, you know, that kind of thing. So it's very, very tricky with festivals too, and in the end you're still going to be 20 grand out of pocket, 30 grand out of pocket, and on top of that, all the festival submission fees that you're going to spend thousands and thousands of pounds submitting it to all these different festivals. So it's a very, very expensive thing to pull off with a very high likelihood of no reward. And in the meantime, you know, filmmakers are losing money. A lot of the times their own money or maybe somebody else's money just to get their own career started. And it's that's not a good place to be, you know, when the risk is that high and the reward is so low, you know. And so what we were thinking of doing with Centerframe is there a way where we can make and create an environment where it's not, you know, where filmmakers can come together and through first of all, sharing the risk through a membership fee. So basically we'd fund these films through people's memberships, you know? So therefore every filmmaker contributes something a little bit, you know, but through collaboration, the best stories would emerge and the people would vote on their favorite projects, you know? And that's the basic idea of it. So the fundamental idea is, think of it like a gym. You know, but instead of spending the money on exercise equipment and facilities and all that stuff, your gym membership fee goes into producing films, you know, and instead of flexing your you know, pecs and your glutes, you know, you're flexing your storytelling muscles. You do that through working together with other filmmakers that are on this, that are in this membership. You know, they basically, we're building these collaboration tools that allow us to give useful and dynamic feedback to each other. And that collaboration is given numerical value. So basically a project that gets submitted or a project somebody's working on has a certain amount of collaboration that's built into it, and people can spot those projects and how well people have worked on. And then every quarter, we're going to do a voting cycle where the membership as a whole votes on which projects they like the most. And those projects are the ones that get funding, you know? And the funding is basically variable. So not all funding is made equal, basically. So some funding is like the lowest tier of funding is effectively festival packages. So if you already have a film and you want to get it out there, and you've spent, every filmmaker has spent all their money already on the production of it. Nobody has ever any money to submit it to festivals. Like very, very few filmmakers have budgeted like that. You know what I mean? That's an extra thing that comes on top of it. So we're thinking, let's give people the opportunity to pitch their film to the community and say, look, I want to send this to festivals. What do you guys think? Are you guys going to help me out on it? And so you show the film to the community, and the community basically votes on which films they like the best. And it's basically a ranked vote. So they pick their top 10. And the films that get the most points basically are the ones that receive funding. And so the bottom tier would be a few grand just for submitting your film to festivals, you know? So that'll pay for all the different fees, you know? Then, of course, higher than that would be things like funding for 5-minute shorts, 10-minute shorts, half an hour shorts, things like that. And the budget goes up appropriately. And another thing then would be like, once we grow to a large enough size, we'd then fund things like web series. So we'd have a nice big number that we'd give towards the production of a web series, because web series are so difficult to fund because there's no business model for them. You know, web series only work if Netflix pays for them, you know, do you know what I mean? Like if Netflix pays for it, then the web series works. You know what I mean? But if it doesn't, then you've spent a ton of money on something that could be very popular on YouTube, but you can't earn money on YouTube either. Not if you're going to spend that kind of money, you know? So this is a way to allow filmmakers to put their best foot forward in terms of their storytelling abilities. Some of them will be writers, some of them are directors, some of them are producers. You know, that's the primary sort of group we're targeting. But I mean, actors could join and be like, I want to work with some directors here. I want to back certain projects, be part of this, that kind of thing. And the thinking is the more members work together on each other's projects, the more the funding benefits more members, you know? So rather than just everybody being a lone wolf looking for their own thing, the more they collaborate with each other, the more the fund, the more it'll benefit, the more members the funding will benefit, you know?
So you've gone through the stages of funding, but in terms of a web series, like I personally have no idea how much it would, the average cost is of a web series on YouTube or Netflix. So how much would Centerframe be looking to give someone if they wanted to produce a web series and it's the one that wins the most points?
I'm not going to get into the specific numbers yet, because one of our what we're doing now is like we have only just launched our pledge. We're designing the tech right now, and our next stage is to build a core community of filmmakers who are going to help us refine this process. So we're looking at 50 filmmakers that we are inviting to come and help us refine the voting, the feedback tools, all this stuff. And what are the things that that would help you make decisions at this point? And so that's our next phase. And the idea is we want to make this community driven from the get-go. Like we don't want to make this a situation where we develop and we build, and then everybody, come on, like we need thousands and thousands of viewers in one, but we've not shown anything to anybody. Like we want to build this from the ground up as a community. And as we start with 50 filmmakers that we invite to help us out. And then we grow it outwards from there and invite more people. And of course, you know, signing up to the mailing list gives us access to a list of people that have early interest. And so these are people we obviously talk to. Like, these are people that we want to, that we go through and say, hey, look, do you want to come in? Do you want to join us? So being part of the mailing list is going to be really, really important, you know, as to becoming an early member of this whole thing. And certainly during the development stage of this. And then once we've grown to a small size, but it's still not open to the public, as in we're still going to be refining all of our tools, all of our software and how the website works, then we'll go public and we'll say, look, come on, filmmakers, come and join us, and we'll go from there. And of course, the more we are, the more productions we can help fund and the more the collaboration works. But we will have to look at how big this can get before it gets so big that nobody connects with each other. So we have to be very, very smart with how you think of it, like a village, you know. If a village is so big that nobody knows each other, then the village stops being an effective community, you know. Then you start slicing out individual communities and that starts getting competitive. And I don't really want to get too far down that road. Now we have a few ideas of how we could deal with that kind of a situation, you know, but that's down the line. We need to get to that level first. You know, I mean, my hope is we want to get to a community of around 10 to 15,000 filmmakers globally. You know what I mean? So this is not like all UK or all US. In fact, we're focusing very much on supporting global cinema because global cinema has all these funding issues. More so than UK US does, you know, for example, France and Germany, they all have funding schemes. A lot of times they're also political or they're specifically issues oriented. Like you need to make certain kinds of movies, you know, they need to be about certain topics and cover certain things. Centerframe is completely content agnostic when it comes to that. Like our whole thing is, it's the community's decision what films they back. We don't choose which films should get made, you know. In fact, our whole core filmmaker group that we're assembling now, that we're trying to get together, they're from all walks of life, you know, male, female, transgender, you know, black, white, Asian, you know, South African, mixed, you know. So that we've got everything, you know. We've got a guy from Brazil who's transgender. He hasn't said yes yet. He's interested in talking to us. And we're assembling a nice wide variety of people from all over, and we want to make this a global community rather than just a regional one. Now we do understand, of course, there are pockets of filmmaking industries, and so we are expecting to see more from certain regions. That's going to be likely, but we don't. Again, we don't want to like push it too hard on either of those. We want to make this a more international experience and expose filmmakers to different ideas and techniques and stories from all over, you know. And that, I think, diversity should drive great storytelling, you know. And that's what we're trying to achieve.
Excellent. I really like the sound of this, and it's completely original. So I really respect you putting the work in for something like this. But the members have a kind of I wouldn't necessarily say a help desk, but will they be able to speak to you a lot at all? Or is it just members talking to each other? Because I mean, you've got some great ideas, and you're the head of this. You've created this. Will they have communication with you?
Oh no! I mean, I will be as active a member as I can. I mean, I will consider myself part of the membership, even though I have to take myself out of the voting on these things because that would be a conflict of interest. Like, I would never put my own projects forward because I assemble all these people to vote for my shit. I mean, that's wrong on multiple levels. You know what I mean? So I would never do that. You know. I absolutely have every intention of being a part of this, and the idea is we want to push constructive collaboration. And one thing that a lot of people that I had to learn the hard way, and I know a lot of people that are active in the industry had to learn the hard way, is what is good feedback, you know, like how do you take feedback and how do you give feedback that's actually useful to other people? Because receiving feedback that shit hurts. You know what I mean? Like when somebody tells you, man, dude, I didn't like your character. You know, I think that's a real problem. And a lot of people don't want to say it because they don't want to piss you off because they want to work with you. You know, so they don't give you honest opinions. But we need to reward like candor, and we need to reward collaboration, you know, and that's what this, that's what the numerical value on the collaboration is for, is that you can reward people for giving really good, useful feedback to you, and they can reward you for receiving feedback and being collaborative and responsive. And that's the interaction that we're trying to foster, is as much of that and as much of open collaboration as possible, because the closed collaboration happens once you get into the industry. Because the problem is, once you get into, well, the problem, it's not a problem, it's the way the industry works. But what happens is that once you get into the actual industry and you're working actively and you're constantly on projects, these projects have a lot of money attached to them. And any ideas that come out first that get taken from something else can lose you a lot of money. So suddenly everybody's on non-disclosure agreements. You can't talk to other people about what they're working on and stuff like that, because financial value basically means you could lose a ton of money if things come out and somebody else rips you off, you know?
Yeah.
But on a lower level, that's not a problem yet, because we're trying to build each other up, you know? And what the hope is with this is that we can, through collaboration, learn the skill of giving and receiving feedback, reward good stories when they come, and build our networks, not just in our backyard where we hope we find somebody that's actually good at this, but in a more global environment where we can collaborate with people that you can actually really learn from. And at the moment, the way it works is that you can use Reddit or you can use Facebook and you'll get some feedback from people and stuff like that, but there's no reward for them. This is out of the good graces of what they're doing. Yeah. But if helping other people helps your project, then that's a good thing. So you're incentivized to help more, you know? And that's what we want to build. You know, we want to build a platform that really rewards collaboration, that really rewards networking as well. Because, for example, to be fair to producers, for example, a lot of producers don't develop. A lot of producers, their job is to get the film made and to find the people to get it out there and to deal with the project. They're not there to read the script and give detailed notes, as some producers do. Most don't. Most have to make connections. Yeah. They have to find the filmmakers. They have to find the distributors. They have to make deals. So if we said it's all about the script collaboration, well, what incentive do producers have? So we're going to reward producers for attending events and meeting people and networking with people, connecting with people, because that's what they need. Yeah, I mean, that's what a producer needs, you know? And so that's, it's going to be, but that's the conversation we're going to have with the filmmakers, with the core audience that we're building at first, just to make sure that these dynamics are fruitful and fair and collaborative. You know, that's the idea behind it, you know?
You mentioned feedback and honest feedback. Can you give us an example of a time when you've got honest feedback and it really helped you?
Like so many times. I've got the good thing is I've got some really great collaborators around me that have managed to assemble over the years. I'm saying it like, oh, you work for me. Like I didn't assemble them. Like we met and we worked together and that kind of thing. But the people I'm working with, like one of my closest collaborators, Luke Foster, he wrote my first two films. And he's the one that basically taught me how to give and receive feedback. Like I learned the core of that from him. And he is one of my most cherished, like, creative treasures, you know, because I can always rely on him to tell me when an idea is really stupid, you know, and he will tell me. And he has this thing that he does, like when I pitch an idea, when it's like, what if we did this? He like starts frowning with his forehead. His forehead goes wrinkly and goes, and I'm like, oh shit, okay, this is not working. But maybe if we did this and that kind of thing. But he's like, him and I have a very, very good collaborative, you know, working relationship. And I have that with quite a few people, but everybody's feedback is different, you know? So I can't, like Luke is, for example, very good at being very specific. His real strength is logic and structure in stories. So if something here happens, that doesn't make any sense down here. Why are you doing that here when that's affecting that thing down there? You really should rethink that. Or, you know, things, he's very good at spotting those kinds of things. He's very good at detailed oriented feedback. But then a couple other people I know, I would never expect that from them. That's not how they think. That's not how they give me feedback. Their strength is in their emotional reaction to a character. So when the emotional core of a character doesn't feel right, they'd be the person to definitely point that out to me. You know, it's like, I don't know, I didn't like that guy. Yeah, I mean, like, I didn't like the way she talked to him. Like, that's felt so wrong. Yeah, I mean, like, compared to everything, I'm just really good at pointing out those moments, things that felt really clear to me. It's like, no, but I don't feel that. And then, of course, you have to parse that across multiple feedbacks you get. And if there's 2, 3, 4 people saying similar things, you kind of should listen to that. You know, no matter how much you might disagree, you should listen, because you might be shooting yourself in the foot because of a principle, you know. And you're giving and receiving feedback is all about pushing your ego and taking what's given to you. But bad feedback, for example, can really ruin how you collaborate with someone, you know, because if they keep shitting on your stuff because they don't know how to point out the stuff that does work and that you should think more about, but only basically immediately go in, well, that doesn't work, that doesn't work, that doesn't work, that doesn't work, blah, blah, blah. But I've had a friend of mine that I went to university with a long time ago. He works in LA. And he's a writer and writes really great stuff, but he writes mostly for TV. Okay. And I asked him for feedback on a screenplay, on my first screenplay I wrote, which is a very, very ambitious thing to write as a first feature script. It's a story called Oxygen, which is about which is set during the French Revolution. And is a big sort of story world as such, and required a lot of feedback and research and feedback and that kind of thing. And it was my first one. I'd never written a feature script before then. I'd written a couple of short films, you know. So it was a big ambition to try and do this. And he basically, in his feedback, like, he wrote me a nice, like, 4-page feedback. I paid him for it. He didn't do it for free, you know what I mean? But I paid him for it. And he, in his opening paragraph, said, okay, just so you know, anything that I don't point out, that I'm not going to go into the stuff that works, because everything that I don't mention here works.
Oh,
all right. Okay. So I'm not in the business of just patting your back or like giving you congratulating things so your ego feels better. But just so you know, if I don't point it out as a problem here, it works. And also, take my feedback with a grain of salt, because half of the stuff I'm going to say, you're probably going to disagree with. You know what I mean? But you know, it's how it is, you know. And he prefaced that. And that's good feedback. That at least puts me in the right frame of mind for the feedback that I'm giving. And that's what a lot of feedback is. Giving feedback is all about considering the frame of mind of the person you're going to say it to, you know. And that's why sometimes you get really shallow, just complimentary feedback, because you don't really want to piss them off because they want to help you. Yeah, like, because they want to work with you. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. So therefore, I love this. I love that. Let's just work on it. You know what I mean? And but what they really think is like, oh man, this is the worst thing I've ever read. You know? So I want to, but good feedback is a learned skill. And unfortunately, also what happens is that the more popular you get, the less likely people are to give you open, clear feedback. You start getting surrounded by yes men.
Yes,
you know?
I've seen that.
And it happens. It happens all the time. You know, it happens in no matter what industry you're in. That happens. People stop giving you honest feedback, and so it's the more successful you get, the more valuable constructive feedback and honest feedback becomes. You know, this is one thing I respect a lot about Disney and Pixar and Disney and the way they've set up their whole story trust thing, because it really fosters and rewards constructive feedback and story development, and that their track record proves that stuff works, you know. But I want to make that, and not the story trust specifically, because that's a very specific technique, but I want to make an environment where giving good feedback is actually to your benefit, and then you can tell it's to your benefit. It's not just some emotional reaction you have to it. it will be useful to you for your project. You know, you will get rewarded for receiving good feedback and giving good feedback. And that's what I want to build.
Wow. That was great stuff you said there about feedback. That's for sure. And lastly, when can people sign up and join CentreFrame?
Signing up to the mailing list is hugely important. So please do. It's where all our updates come. So we're in the moment. We are in the community building phase. So we are looking actively looking for people that we can collaborate with as part of our sort of early community. And we are going through the people that have signed up to our mailing list to see which filmmakers would be very interesting. At the moment, we're primarily looking for very experienced people who have done very well, simply because we know they already have the feedback skills, and we can tap into that knowledge and knowledge base in order to do that. And we are trying to cater as much to experienced filmmakers as we are trying to cater to new ones, you know, because I do think that what we can offer, especially on a script development level, I think we can offer to take the sting out of screenplay development for indie producers, because the problem is, once if you have an idea and you want to develop an idea and you don't have that much capital, what you could do is you could team up with a writer at CentreFrame that you meet here, and then you say, look, would you be interested in developing this idea with me, and we can apply for funding from the writing community because they like your idea, and then you can get funding to develop your project. That is one of the ways that we want to do that, but that requires established producers to think that this is a valuable proposition for their story development and for the indie development. And what's actually really important, and I really want to mention this here, CentreFrame does not take control of IP, of intellectual property. Like this, all the IP rests with the IP owners. That is not our back. You know what I mean? That does not belong to us in any way, shape, or form. Mainly because, first of all, it's a nightmare in terms of getting into that kind of arguments with people. This is an argument that has to take place outside of CentreFrame. Like, we will not get involved in that whatsoever. You know, this is the ownership relies is solely on being the creative's responsibility. So it is their stuff. Yeah, you know what I mean? And we don't want to own your stuff. We want to help you make your stuff, but that doesn't mean we want to own it, you know? And because it's good that the creative keeps a hold of it, but it's good for us that we suddenly aren't part of it, because that is the problem production companies went into when they starts taking on a project. Suddenly they have an ownership of this IP, and then if something happens with that, the writer sits here going, so I developed this idea and nothing happens with it, you know what I mean? So again, this is a conversation that is between the creatives themselves that has nothing to do with what we do, you know?
I see.
Does that make sense?
Completely.
And that's really important. So that's, you know, that's as much of a service to the filmmakers as it is a protection for us to not get into that kind of game.
Amazing. That's brilliant. And I'll be putting every link I can possibly find about CentreFrame in the show notes and about yourself. So everybody go and take a look at CentreFrame and what they've got on offer. It's worthwhile. I really believe it's worth checking out and thinking about, especially now I've just spoken to Bernard and he's explained a lot more about it to me. So Bernard, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I really, really appreciate it. And we'll definitely catch up and speak soon.
If you like this podcast, share it with friends, leave a comment in the comment section, and hit the subscribe button.